In Western societies where the most basic notions of right and wrong are not only denied but actively suppressed, recovering a biblical and distinctly Christian understanding of the natural law is absolutely essential.
Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Traditionally, Christians have understood that man is not born a blank slate just waiting to be programmed like a machine. We are moral creatures whose imaginations are darkened by sin. Yet every person still has a basic understanding of right and wrong, because God has revealed it to us in his creation through natural law. Denying the vital role of natural law has grave consequences, not only for society, but for the church's crucial task of proclaiming the gospel.
You can meet and hear Aaron Wolf making the case for natural law Friday, June 9th and Saturday, June 10th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org.
Secularism is the dominant religion in America, and I would say more specifically, secular progressivism is the dominant religion in many American institutions.
I have often said that the term adiaphron has become, in many instances, among us Lutherans, of the theological escape hatch.
If you want to know what it means to be a man, if you want a perfect picture of masculinity, get yourself a crucifix, because the cross is the most masculine thing that has ever happened.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love Issues Etc.
I don't think that there is, well, probably issues equal to, but few that surpass the long-term importance in American politics and society as education. Education is fundamental. It's considered a basic right. It's considered so important that we require a minimum of it. We heavily regulate it, and well, to tell you the truth, it's controlled from the top. And the issue in the crisis of American education is as much one of control as it is of curriculum. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. Live this Wednesday afternoon, May the 3rd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking with Joy Pullman of The Federalist about ending educational monopolies, really one big monopoly if you stop and think about it. A little bit later, Pastor Brian Wolfmiller joins us for part 8 of our series on Christian devotion. We'll talk about daily repentance. Most people don't think about that as an integral part of their devotion, but it really is and should be. Then we'll conclude our series on Lutheran identity with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, author of the book Hallmarks of Lutheran Identity, talking about some of the hallmarks that are particular to the Lutheran Reformation. You can join us for the next 2 hours with questions or comments, or call in number 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet @issuesetc. And for our beloved on-demand listeners, anytime you listen, you can use the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about ending educational monopolies, Joy Pullman, a mother of four, managing editor of The Federalist and author of the new book, The Education Invasion, How Common Core Fights Parents for Control of American Kids. Joy, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Recently, looking at your book and reading your articles on education, I simply assumed that the Department of Education was a very old department in the American government bureaucracy, and that it probably was, you know, turn of the century, last century, and maybe at the latest, a post-war development in government. Is that true?
Well, no. The modern U.S. Department of Education at the federal level was inaugurated under the presidency of Jimmy Carter. Now, there were some smaller kind of sub-departments and programs that the federal government had run that relate to education before that, but the way that we think of it and know it, you know, that department and all of its activities didn't happen until about 40, 50 years ago.
And almost from the very outset, after the Carter years, then-President Ronald Reagan entered office determined to eliminate it. Why did he think it was unnecessary?
Well, the department was actually created out of, it actually may have won Carter the presidency. He had a very tight race in getting to the presidency and only managed one term, was kicked out by Reagan. And part of the reason that Carter managed to get into office was that the, you know, late breaking, he received the support of national teachers unions basically in return for promising them that he would establish the U.S. Department of Education. So it was created basically for political reasons, and it has ever since continued to exist as a political body, and it wields a lot of political influence, just as teachers unions on a local level continue to really be political bodies, although they keep telling everyone, of course, because it furthers their interest that, you know, they're really there to help teachers.
Does that help explain why Reagan ultimately failed at eliminating Department of Education?
Well, there's actually a really interesting story there that I found out by reading a scholar, a new book from an Independence Institute scholar named Vicki Alger. She's been a colleague of mine. She's been working on it for several years, and I've been talking with her about it. And so I just got it in my hands, and she told this story that I'd never heard before. And anyway, and long story short, Reagan came into office promising to eliminate the U.S. Department of Education, but he made the fatal mistake of appointing to lead it what he had planned for a very short amount of time, one of the men in the Senate who had actually advocated for and voted for it existing. So he basically put at the head of this institution to get rid of it a fellow who wanted it to be there. And so this fellow was clever. What he did was use a report that the Reagan administration put out. It's a famous report called The Nation at Risk. Basically came out and has, you know, the famous sentence that something like, you know, if a foreign power had imposed our education system on the nation, we would have considered it an act of war, talking about how terrible American public schools were. And the whole point of the report was to create a crisis so that Americans would be afraid about how terrible their public education was, to justify the continued existence of federal control over education. And it worked. So, Reagan could no longer at that point politically be able to fulfill his promise to get rid of the education department, and still is there today.
So the person who was tasked with trying to eliminate the Department of Education actually cemented its position by inventing this. I mean, there were problems with public education.
Oh, yeah.
But
right.
Exacerbating it and cemented its position.
Right. And see, the interesting, thing is, of course, you know, looking back on the research, we know that a lot of the things the Nation at Risk report was pointing out were true. Americans' schooling and their literary quality, their verbal skills had declined precipitously by the 1980s from the 1950s. So that was accurate. The real problem was, you know, the answer that came about, the media and politicians basically pushed for continued centralization of control. And that was part of the reason that American education was having these very problems in the first place. So the report, you know, did point out some real problems that continue to exist and grow, but it recommended precisely the wrong solution.
And then I guess we should say, just for the sake of history's sake, that from that point on, we had No Child Left Behind. We had all kinds of educational initiatives that were usually at the top of a president's agenda, regardless of their party affiliation, and it's pretty much an entrenched part of the bureaucracy today.
Absolutely. So I consider education a really, the American founders consider, and that's why I do, education crucial to maintaining self-government, a unique American system of being able to manage your own affairs yourself. You have to be a rational, thinking, well-studied creature and able to be good at that. Public education is very important to me and to the American founders. However, neither of us think that the way that we do it nowadays, you know, running it through various nests of bureaucracies, is a way of getting, you know, of inculcating the good thought, habits of mind, the good understanding of history that American citizens need in order to, you know, keep perpetuating our great country.
All right, then let's talk about our latest president, Donald Trump, and the latest promise to deal with the educational crisis. It comes in the form of an executive order. How do you evaluate it?
So President Trump has been doing a lot of executive orders lately, kind of for the same reason that Barack Obama, you know, resorted to those. He can't get Congress to do what he wants, and that's kind of important. So, feeling frustrated, even though he's only been in office a couple of months, he's kind of making statements with a bunch of executive orders and actions. So he did one on education because folks had noticed, you know, he promised very explicitly and repeatedly on the campaign trail, you know, to end Common Core and to restore local control in education. And really to do that, that requires Congress to get on board. They have to repeal, they have to decentralize education control starting at the federal level. level working its way down, because that is where so many resources are tied up. So President Trump can't do that himself, but what he did in his executive order, I think, could lead to that if he and his team are smart. And so I suggested that Secretary Education Secretary DeVos take his commission in that executive order to basically study where federal regulations break federal law to impede local and parent administration of education, you know, and within 300 days put out a report on to that effect. So if my idea is that Secretary DeVos would use that opportunity to kind of remand the nation at risk problem, to use her report, yes, as another kind of signal event in the education sphere, but rather than using it to push more consolidation of power at the federal level, to recommend basically dismantling her department and proposing a wise plan for how to do so.
So how can that, if that's how the executive order is implemented at that departmental level, how can that inform the necessary legislation to make something like this occur?
Well, what it could basically do is provide a template for legislation that would be taken to Congress. And it also could do some, you know, the president and his secretary have a really important bully pulpit. You know, Secretary DeVos could use, I mean, almost anyone's going to accept, you know, the request of Secretary DeVos to appear in their state, at their school, at their event. So she can go on the trail and take, you know, her message across the country explaining why the federal government is the source of so many problems in education and what the refinings of her report were on that regard. The evidence is plentiful. She can, you know, show it to the American people and build the will among them and our representatives to get this through Congress.
Why is it so important that we not simply go back to business as usual and say we're going to try and nickel and dime education back into good form, or we're going to just do marginal change here? We may even reform the Department of Education, but not eliminate it. Why is it so important that we not allow this opportunity?
It's simply because people have been saying that ever since the department was established, and none of it has ever come to fruition. We've been trying the same thing over and over and again. Everything that the consultant, the bureaucrat class, says is going to work, we've been trying what they have said for 50 years, and American education is getting worse. And we say that not only, you know, in kids' just basic, you know, test score ability, their literacy ability, that has declined very significantly from the 1950s. But we also see it in things like, you know, the number of Americans who simply read a book in a year. It's only, you know, only 2/3 of Americans don't even read a whole book in a year. They don't pay attention to politics. You know, they aren't doing basic aspects of self-governance. And again, if we want to preserve our unique system of government, it's crucial that Americans have that capacity developed. And so historically, the only way to do that is through giving the people who are at the center of the problem, parents, families, and communities, the most amount of power. We need to stop tying their hands behind their backs and thinking that people who aren't talking to kids know anything about them, and let the people who are with those kids every day be in charge of their education once again.
Someone's going to say, well, the U.S. Department of Education came into existence because of the NEA, the teachers' lobby, so to speak, union. And that's going to be the major obstacle for anyone trying to eliminate it. Is it realistic to think in those terms?
I don't actually think so. I mean, there are a lot of people who really care about teachers' unions and unions in general. I mean, they have historically had very significant effects on education politics. But I actually think that is kind of last century's battle. Teachers' unions are waning in importance. They are important at the local level. But they basically become immediately irrelevant once parents have the individual power to choose where their child is going to go to school and what that kind of schooling will look like. So teachers' unions, of course, will raise a big stink about it. But you know what? Republicans weren't voted into office by teachers' unions, and they haven't been for 10, 20 years now. So they don't know anything into that, you know, to them or their constituents. So it will not hurt them one bit if they don't pay any attention to what they have to say.
Why is school choice and the devil's in the details of how that's defined? Why is that simply not a sufficient answer?
Well, that's a good question. The short answer is that I like to use the term parent choice because it talks about the individual family rather than school choice, because that implies that maybe the school ought to be controlling what parents are allowed to do, you know, and teach their kids. A lot of people have found that school choice is publicly popular. It gets really good ratings on public opinion polls. It gets really good reviews from parents who are able to access it through various state programs. So they are trying to use it to basically give parents the same old things that bureaucrats want, and that's really unfair and deceptive. So people, when they hear someone touting school choice, they need to really look under the hood and see if this person is being an honest advocate for really giving genuine options and genuine freedom to parents on an individual level, or whether they're just using language that sounds good, you know, to deliver the same old centrally controlled education that Americans have been suffering under for a century.
So in summary, are you simply saying that what was begun or actually kind of cemented with that report in 1983, Nation at Risk, ought to finally get answered?
Yes. I mean, I think there's aspects of it that need to be just flat out turned around, such as, you know, cementing the U.S. Department of Education. But there also are aspects of it that do remain fulfilled, such as its commentary on the abysmal state of public education in the United States.
Joy Pohlman is a mother of four children. She is managing editor of The Federalist and author of a new book, The Education Invasion, How Common Core Fights Parents for Control of American Kids. When you purchase this book using the Amazon link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click the Listen on Demand page, and look for The Education Invasion by Joy Pohlman. Joy, by the way, will be back with us on Friday for an in-depth one-hour interview on Common Core. Joy, thanks.
Thank you.
When we come back on this Wednesday afternoon, Pastor Brian Wolfmiller will be with us. We've been doing a series on Christian devotion. Today, we're going to take up an element that is often omitted but is very necessary, daily repentance. Stay tuned.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues, Etc. Making the Case conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $120 to Issues, Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship, or you can make your $120 check payable to Issues, Etc., write scholarship in the memo line, and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues, Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship. lcms.org/stewardship.